Thanks for joining us today. I'm Scott Harrop, Senior Associate Editor with today's Pentecostal Evangel, and my guest today is Richard Hammer. Richard Hammer serves as legal counsel for the U.S. Assemblies of God. He's a nationally recognized authority on legal and tax issues for religious organizations and has written more than 50 books and publishes two newsletters in this field. But Rich is also a dedicated astronomer with more than 30 years of systematic observation and astrophotography to his credit. NASA published his image of M33, the Pinwheel Galaxy and Triangulum, as an astronomy picture of the day in 2004, and he has earned an array of awards for his hundreds of logged observations. Thanks for joining us today, Rich. How did you get started in astronomy?
Well, that's a good question, Scott. I would say that as a young child, I didn't have any apparent interest in astronomy. But then during my junior year in high school, two things happened that triggered a lifelong passion for this avocation. And the first was my younger brother acquired a very small telescope, and he began using it. And he kept asking me to come out and view through it with him, and I didn't really have any interest in doing that. But one night he was persistent, and so I went out into our backyard, and he had found Saturn. And even though that was only a 4-inch telescope, and you could barely see the ring of Saturn, nonetheless, there it was. And I was transfixed by it. Mm. So, and then the second thing was, a very good friend of mine in high school obtained a 6-inch telescope, and I did a lot of observing with him from his driveway. He ended up going on to get a PhD in theoretical astrophysics from the University of Illinois, and he's taught at many leading institutions around the world since then. So, and you know, Scott, I would just say this as well, that the viewing of Saturn as a high school student, how that had that incredible impact on my life, that very same phenomenon I see happen over and over again. In fact, I would divide the human population into two groups. One group could look at a galaxy 100 million light years away through my telescope as a rather small smudge in most cases, and they're mildly interested, and they'll say, where's my video game? But there's about 1 out of 10 or 1 out of 20 people will look at that object, and they'll be changed, just like I was.
Sure.
And you never can predict who it's going to be. I had an attorney friend of mine come over to our house a few years ago when I had my telescope in the driveway, and he just observed for maybe 5 or 10 minutes with me. And he told me later that that was one of the top 10 experiences of his life.
Wow.
And that's what astronomy can do with you, do to a person, is it can trigger that passion that happened to me, and it's happened to countless others.
You know, for people that aren't into astronomy, they might wonder what you mean when you say a 4-inch or a 6-inch, and I believe now you've got a 20...
I have an 18-inch as well as a 15-inch.
Okay, and when we say those dimensions, what are we talking about?
We're talking about the diameter of the primary lens or mirror. Hmm. So in my case, I have what's called a Ritchie Cretan, which is 15-inch diameter mirror. And then I have an 18-inch Newtonian reflector, which again is an 18-inch diameter. Now, that telescope stands about 7 feet tall.
Amazing.
So it is a large telescope.
And again, some people who aren't in the field might wonder, well, what can a scope like that do? And you've probably found, let's compare it to the human eye. A scope your size, how many thousands of times dimmer an object can that scope perceive than what a human eye could?
Well, that's a good question, and I would suppose that under a dark location, I would be able to see tens of thousands of times fainter than the human eye can see.
That's astounding. This week's issue of today's Pentecostal Evangel asks the question, what does science tell us about God? How has studying astronomy influenced your understanding of God and impacted your faith?
Well, Scott, in several ways, and let me just comment briefly on three of them. The first thing I've learned from astronomy is kind of a confirmation of God's existence. And this kind of swerves into what astronomers and scientists call the anthropic principle. And that's a principle. It comes from the Greek word anthropos, which means man. And it essentially means that the universe is so fine-tuned for life that it all points to a divine origin.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that the more you study astronomy, the more you see these parameters that are so exquisitely fine-tuned for life that you can only come to the conclusion that there is a divine presence behind it all. So there are hundreds of these parameters, literally, that have been discovered in recent decades, and that number is growing. And so I would say that today, it's just unbelievable, but so many scientists are acknowledging, even if they're agnostic in their orientation, that there has to be a divine purpose behind it all, because these parameters are so finely tuned. And what am I talking about? Well, just to take one out of several hundred to give you an example of what I'm talking about, the ratio of the mass of an electron to the mass of a proton at the atomic level, that ratio is fine-tuned to the order of 10 to the 37th power. Now, it's hard for us to even begin to grasp what 10 to the 37th power is, but let me give you this illustration that one astronomer has used, and that is, if you would take a pile of dimes and cover the surface of the North American continent, Canada, Alaska, the United States, Mexico, and cover it with dimes, and you just keep adding to the depth of the dimes. In fact, just an area, just a mile square, the national debt of the United States, multiple trillions of dollars, would only cover a few inches.
Oh my.
But if you take the entire North American continent, cover it with dimes, up to the height of the moon, 240,000 miles, and then you take a billion more piles the same size.
Oh, man.
And in those billion piles, the size of the North American continent of dimes going all the way from the Earth to the moon, there's one dime that has been painted red.
Okay.
You have a friend blindfold himself, and you say, pick out one dime from those piles. The chance of him picking out the red one is 10 to the 37th power. That's the fine-tuning we're talking about here. Many of these fine-tuned parameters are much more improbable than that.
Okay.
So when you look at these, you're just amazed. And I would have to say, it is true for many secular-minded scientists. They're acknowledging an apparent purpose to it all, or a mind behind it all. And those that continue to reject the possibility that God created the universe increasingly are doing so not on the basis of the evidence, but on the basis of ideology.
Okay.
You take a person like Carl Sagan or Albert Einstein. They were so repulsed and horrified at the thought that there was a personal God who loved them and wanted to spend eternity with them, that they would have rejected the God hypothesis no matter how strong the evidence, because it was an ideological conclusion on their part. And you know what? They have their wish, don't they?
Yeah.
They get to spend eternity apart from the God who loved them and sent his son to die for them and save them. Now, so that's the first thing I've learned about God from astronomy.
Yeah.
Let me mention a couple of others.
Please.
God is a God of order and design. So first of all, God exists. Secondly, he is a God of order and design. And we see that in this anthropic principle that I just mentioned. These hundreds of parameters that are fine-tuned for life to be possible show that God is a God of order. You know, I was asked to speak recently to a group of ministers, and I mentioned this to them because it's really impressed itself upon me that if God has fine-tuned the universe to this extraordinary, incomprehensible level, who are we to think that he has not ordered our lives? And what a powerful thought that has been for me, that sometimes we look at human suffering, for example, or problems that beset us, and we wonder, where is God? Let me assure you, he is there. And he has fine-tuned your life to a degree that you cannot even comprehend, just like most people go about their lives without any comprehension of the fine-tuned parameters in the universe that make life possible. Similarly, I think we, most if not all of us, go about our lives never really fully apprehending the divine purpose that God has for us. And many times we just have to accept that in faith. But I think the anthropic principle teaches us that we serve a God who is concerned about the details, even though we don't understand it.
Yeah.
You know, Aquinas once said, let me paraphrase, that if you can imagine going to get your mail, if you have a mailbox at the street, you go across your front yard and an earthworm sticks its head above the ground and sees you walking to the mailbox, in what sense can that worm have any comprehension of what you're doing? And the fact is, it can't. You could stand there and tell it, I'm going to get the mail. It can't comprehend it. The gulf is too vast.
Yeah.
And yet the gulf between us and God is infinitely greater than that.
Mm.
So for us to think, I don't get it, well, so be it. I mean, we put our faith in the providence of a God who is infinitely superior to ourselves. Now, let me mention the third thing, and that is the love of God. That's what astronomy teaches me.
Oh, wonderful.
And what I mean is this. If you look at Psalms 8, verses 3 and 4, it says, when I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have set in place, what is man that you are mindful of him? We're a speck on a speck on a speck on a speck. And yet, what is man that thou art mindful of him? Yet John 3:16 tells us that God so loved the world, this little speck we live on, that he gave his only begotten son to die for us, that we might have eternal life. That's an amazing verse of scripture to me put in the context of astronomy. Because in this vast universe, God has singled out Earth as a place that he loved so much. He sent his son to die in our place. And that's an amazing thing out from astronomy.
It staggers the imagination. You mentioned astronomers who don't believe in God, but a number of history's great astronomers had a strong belief in God. Could you give us some examples?
Absolutely. I think I would lead off the list with Isaac Newton himself, no doubt the greatest scientist who ever lived, in my opinion, and in the opinion of most. He was a committed Christian, although he was a Unitarian, which, by the way, haunted him for the last several years of his life because he was a professor of all places at Trinity College at Cambridge University. But he was convinced that there was a God. Wasn't even a question. In fact, up through the most of the 19th century, the vast majority of astronomers and scientists were Christian. And I think what happened, and there are many reasons to explain what happened, but I think one of the principal developments was with Charles Darwin. Following the Darwinian Revolution in the mid to late 19th century, I think there emerged this gulf between faith and science, and that Christians and people of faith increasingly looked upon science as an enemy, as something that was going to attack our core beliefs. And as a result, fewer and fewer people went into the sciences. Hmm. They didn't agree with Newton, who said, of all people, Christians ought to be the ones pursuing scientific study. Because what are we doing? We're uncovering how God ordered the universe, God's creation, his laws, his principles of nature. Of all people, we as Christians should be the ones exploring this, not abdicate the field and leave it occupied by those who oppose God and his kingdom and ignore his, you know, his very existence. So I think that was a watershed, 150 years ago. But I'm happy to say that in recent decades, I see this turning around with more and more Christian young people pursuing scientific study. Let me give you an example. One of the leading universities in the world for astronomical studies has, by my last count, five evangelical Christians on the faculty, doctorates in astrophysics. And a growing number of scientists are Christian in their orientation and faith. And that's exciting to me. So I think we've turned the corner. And I think the anthropic principle is helping here because more and more scientists are being forced to acknowledge that God exists.
Mm.
There's no other way to explain it.
Yeah. Your website, www.seetheglory, all three words written out together, .com, offers a detailed archive of your astrophotography, and along with your image that NASA accepted of the Pinwheel Galaxy, what are some highlights on the site you were fortunate to have captured?
Well, I, of course, would consider every one of those images to be unique in its own sense, in its own perspective. I would say that picture of the Pinwheel Galaxy is probably my favorite because that was an astronomy picture of the day that NASA selected. Several other pictures have been given awards by other various publications. But I would point out that each of the pictures has a detailed description under it. I put a lot of time describing what you're looking at. So it's not just a pretty picture, but I give some sense of the magnitude of it, how big this thing is, what caused it, what created it, how far away it is. And I think people will find it very educational, all from a Christian perspective, those explanations. And then I think really an exciting aspect of my website is just over the last few months, I've been able to have a new feature which consists of MP3 recordings, digital recordings, of most of my lectures in astronomy that I give every spring at Evangel University. I teach a course there, an introductory course in astronomy. And this past spring, for the first time, I recorded those lectures. And it's taken some time, but the bottom line is those are now available as MP3 files. You can listen to them by just clicking on the tab that says podcast on the menu screen of my website, and you can see a detailed description of each of those lectures, so you can see what the content is, listen to the ones you wish, or you can download those and transfer those to your iPod and listen to them whenever you want. Again, this is kind of unique in the sense that it's a comprehensive review of astronomy. There are tens of hours of lecture, and it's all from a Christian perspective. So I encourage our listeners to check that out.
I've enjoyed your website. I've visited it a number of times, and a lot of your cross-referencing. You've won, I believe, the Herschel Award and the Messier Award for different observations you've made, and everything is linked together in a fascinating way. Even for a layman like myself, you can get out there and find a whole lot of material that's interesting and not really overwhelming. It just kind of opens your eyes.
Scott, if I could just interject something here.
Sure.
Because a lot of our listeners are listening to us today and are thinking, you know, I really need to get a telescope for my kids or maybe my grandchildren. And I'm asked that question all the time. I would just like to make a comment about that. You know, everybody, in my opinion, is born a scientist. We are born with a natural desire to explore. And I had I heard a world-famous astrophysicist a few years ago, Michio Kaku, one of the world-leading thinkers on string theory, comment on this, and actually emailed him and to discuss this further. But his view is that, like I said, we're all born astronomers with a natural curiosity of the natural world. And then we start junior high school or middle school, and what happens? Science becomes a matter of memorizing the parts of a flower or the periodic table of elements, and they suck the joy out of these kids, and they leave them shriveled. And so how do you inoculate yourself against that? Well, Kaku says at age 9 or 10, just before they start middle school or junior high school, that's the time to get them. Give them a telescope. Something that they will just – their interest will, in nature will explode, and it will inoculate them against the years to come. And I think that's a great idea. So those of you that have children 8 to 10 or 11, grandchildren, that is the perfect age to get a telescope. And if you'd like my personal recommendations on that, I'd be glad to share those. You can email me just by visiting the website. There's an email link directly to me, and I would be glad to share with you my personal recommendations. Let's get some more Isaac Newtons out there among our listening audience.
Absolutely. Yeah, a lot of parents who get that bug and want to do something like that for their kids make the mistake of buying the first little tube telescope they see in a department store, and it creates the opposite reaction. They don't get the kind of views they expected. It gathers dust in a closet somewhere.
Yes.
So knowing some key characteristics to look for in a decent-priced scope can make all the difference. Astronomy is something that you see in the headlines. Things are changing all the time. In my mind, I kind of associate astronomy, the science, with some of the developments that are going on with attempts to increase space travel, some of the things that grab the public's attention. Where do you see astronomy headed in this next decade along those fronts?
Well, I think the big next development is going to be in 2013 or maybe within the next few years after that. NASA is going to launch the James Webb Orbiting Space Telescope, which would be the successor to the Hubble Space Telescope. The last repair mission for the Hubble is going up next year, and then that's going to be allowed to die a slow death. That's been a historic treasure, that instrument. 94-inch diameter, so it's by no means the biggest telescope in the world. The biggest telescopes are 10-meter Keck telescopes, 400-inch diameter. And there are some even bigger ones under construction currently. The James Webb telescope will be a little, maybe 2.5 times the diameter of the Hubble Space Telescope. It'll be about 21 feet in diameter. The Hubble is about 8. So it'll have about 6 to 7 times more light-gathering power than the Hubble Space Telescope. It's going to be a truly remarkable, a breathtaking instrument, the discoveries that it will make. And one of its chief missions, as well as many of the largest Earth-based telescopes today, is to solve really the holy grail of astronomy today, and that is an explanation of the dark matter and dark energy. In recent years, astronomers have learned that over 95% of the matter and energy in the universe is detectable because of its gravitational influence, but it's not visible or detectable in any other way. We can't see it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the chair you're sitting in or the car you're sitting in or wherever you are listening to us, you know, you reach around and touch something that's physical. What you're looking at or feeling there is a tiny fraction of the real universe. Over 95% of the universe, the current estimate is, consists of this dark energy and dark matter. And I think over the next 10 years or so, Scott, there's going to be a lot of effort expended in uncovering or explaining that mystery of what exactly is – how can we explain dark matter and dark energy.
Yeah. Any other comments?
It's an exciting time to be alive. There's never been a time to compare to it in all of the history of science, especially because of that anthropic principle that I mentioned earlier. We are learning so much about the universe, how God ordered it, and it just these fine-tuned parameters that are so improbable and unlikely that it's pointing to a divine origin. All of that, to me, is almost making it too easy to believe in God. I'm reminded of Thomas, who said, "I will not believe until I see with my own eyes the risen Christ and place my fingers in the holes in his hands and in the hole in his side."
Mm-hmm.
Jesus comes into the meeting of the disciples and walks up to Thomas, and he says, "Behold my hands and my side." And Thomas puts his fingers in there, and he falls on his knees, and he says, "My Lord and my God." And Jesus says an interesting thing. Thomas, you have believed because you have seen, but blessed are those who believe who have not seen. And historically, that's been true of the Christian faith. We believe, although we do not see. But I'll just tell you, as an astronomer, in recent years and recent decades, the mounting level of evidence of God's existence is so overwhelming that it's almost too easy. Are we still accepting God's existence on the basis of that childlike faith without which it's impossible to approach him?
Good point. Yeah. Thanks for joining us today, and I hope everyone who tuned in has gotten a new appreciation for what astronomy can contribute to your life and to your faith. Thanks very much.